He was a great speaker and a great mensch, plain and simple. And he was able to get along with everyone. In other words, he had within him, I think he was a Torah Vadas graduate, if I'm not mistaken, but I can be corrected. It's not a YU graduate, but he was able to get along with everyone. And he was very close to Rabbi Parnas. Teddy Parnas, they lived near each other. They're very. I may have even lived in the same building. I remember I was their guest once. I recall they may have even been in the same building. Anyway, ready to roll. A world to do. Let me take off my watch. The clock behind us is working for China, but not for Israel. I have answers to Jack's questions as well. Today is Monday, May 20th, 2019, and the year is grinding to an end, but next week is normal, and then we'll worry for the final session. Baruch Hashem, there's a lot on my plate now, and as usual, the book will be a mad rush to make it by the time I go to America. It always happens, so it's part of life, but Bezrat Hashem, nitgaber. All the pictures, you know what I'm talking about, Yitzchak? This book is a very hard one to put together. There are four different sections. And the person in charge of running it and putting it together, who puts out Svarim endlessly, those are Svarim that it's one text. This is four different sections. Each one is a world unto itself. So Baruch Hashem, I just got acknowledgement that he now has all the pictures. Can I hurry? I have no idea. It's gone back and forth. But it doesn't matter. Let me pick up where I left off. First of all, a good morning to all the students in front of me and to all those listening across the big Jewish universe. I've gotten a lot of favorable comment on my talk last week. I just read some of the emails now and others that I received earlier. There's only one problem. Emails do not tell you where they're from. That people who live in Israel like what I said is no chiddush to me. They're living here. I want to know what they're saying in Washington Heights. And that I can't figure out. I've gotten emails, and some of them I have nice words, but where are you living? Now, one thing I said very quickly last week, and people asked me about it, so it's a very important concept. Let me give you the source. And let me say it in a few words. Open up the Sefer Mitzvot. Mitzvah Aleph. Ki hatzivui shetzivonu behamanat halokut v'hu sheneman na'amin sheyesham ila v'siba hu poel l'kol hanipoel l'kol hanimtzim v'hu amro anochi Hashem Elokecha. Alright. A mitzvah to believe that there's a God, that there's someone running this world who cares, who created, who commanded. No, you open up the Hilchat, the Bahag, the Hilchat Gedolot, you will see he doesn't count this as a mitzvah. So the Ramban, already in his comment on the on Maimonides, attempts to justify the Bahag, and he says, I'm quoting now from the commentary of the Ramban on Mitzvah Asei Aleph. And the Ramban says, "Vanire mi daito shabal ha-hilchot, shein min yad tayat mitzvah, dalik izay ratav, shegazara leinu lasolt amananu shalonase, aval remuna b'metziyuto yitalesh odio otonu eilenu b'yokotu mavsimu b'gila shkina v'aneinu, hu ha'ikar v'hashoresh, Shemimenu noldu hamitzvot lo yimana b'cheshbon." And that's the famous words of the Ramban. The Megillat Esther takes him to task. He justifies the Ramban. It's the usual. The Ramban justifies the Bahag, and the Megillat Esther justifies Maimonides. But what the Ramban is saying is very important. Mitzvot asay, mitzvot alosa say, God told you to do this, God told you not to do this. But the whole source of mitzvah, the whole source of these concepts, the whole source of Torah, is that there's a Ribbono Shel Olam that is so basic, it's not counted as a mitzvah. It's the basis of all our existence, the Torah and all that goes with it. And that's what I was referring to. I heard from the Rav a number of times. Others have written it. There's the tremendous question, and you're all familiar with this, and you heard Rabbi Willick talk about it in New York on Thursday, Yom HaTzmut. Why is in mitzvah Yishev HaAretz a mitzvah according to Maimonides? It's a good question. The Ramban takes him to task. Look into the Ramban, mitzvah Taseh, in back of the Sefer, where he adds to the Maimonides count. And the Ramban takes him to task, and the famous Ramban, and there's the Ramban in Chumash, I believe two different times where he's so clear, and Maimonides doesn't mention it. And the answer is very simple. There's a long tshuva, by the way, of the Abnav Nezer, the Sach tshuva, that everyone talks about, also on this very topic. And the basic answer is very simple. That the mitzvah of Yishev HaAretz is so basic to one half of the Torah that without that, Seder Zrayim, Kodshim, and Tara don't get off the floor. You follow? So it's like Anochi Hashem Elokecha. You can't have Kabbonot, you can't have Zrayim, you can't have Shviyas, you can't have Yovel. There's so much involved that there's no need to say mitzvah Yishev HaAretz is a mitzvah Taseh. It's a mitzvah to say 100 times over, 200 times over, 300. Look at every mitzvah. Look at half of Shas. And look, that's what I was referring to, that please don't dismiss, like the Ramban, don't dismiss it so easily. It's not that Maimonides disagrees. It could be Maimonides is even deeper than Nachmanides. Because he holds there's no need to list it out. It's like Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Okay, that's what I was referring to. I also want to make a small correction, which is natural, a slip of the tongue. I mentioned the Rabbi Green of Hamilton went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Listen, I lived it. I know what I'm talking about. I don't want to elaborate now. I have a lot to do today. And he went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and the Rebbe told him, Chas v'chalili, you should leave Hamilton. So I called him Label Green. His name was Morty Green. Charlie, you know why I called him Label Green? His classmate, his friend, his sidekick, they got smicha together, was Label Dulitz. Remember Rabbi Label Dulitz? So in my mind, it always gets intertwined. These mistakes, you can't help. A psychologist will explain it to you. If we did research at Harvard, he'll explain it. Now, Jack asked me a question yesterday. Shir, everyone loved the shir. Everyone was shocked by this chiddush. I mean, it is a tremendous chiddush. It's like he sounds like a left wing Orthodox rabbi. And who are we talking about? We're talking about the Eid HaRedid. So what happened? What happened to Reb Moshe? How does this come? The answer is very simple. He was rubbed in South Africa. And this man didn't grow up in a igloo. He didn't grow up in Mea Sharim. He didn't grow up in Rabarila's backyard in Mea Sharim. He grew up in London, in England. He grew up, he was a rabbi in South Africa. And you see how that influenced his thinking. And particularly in South Africa, you have to understand, I've said this many times, you've heard it from me, I lived it, I saw it, I experienced it. South Africa has the largest percentage of Shomer Shabbos Jews of any community in the world outside of Israel. It probably borders on 30 plus percent, I don't know, something South Africa can correct me. 90% of these Shomer Shabbos Jews are Balei Tshuva. So what Reb Moshe probably held is very simple, that let them drive, let them come, let them see. Look how many have been influenced. And this is what they answered me in Atlanta, Georgia. Labriot, when in Atlanta, Georgia, I saw the parking lot, I heard it was open Shabbos, I saw it with my own eyes. So they told me that the Rosh Yeshiva of Bnei Yisrael was matir, they should keep the parking lot open. It would cause too much of a conflict if they tried to close it at that time. And leave it open. And the people in Atlanta, Georgia boast that there's not one Jew using the parking lot on Shabbos. Even though technically it's open, but everyone who used it became Balei Tshuva, and in Atlanta began the concept of a Shabbos house. No, you know what a Shabbos house means, right? The Vic Snow didn't see a Shabbos house on the east side of New York. And believe me, Charlie didn't see it in Washington Heights. But where the Jews live in suburbia and have money, they have a mansion out where they have plenty of land and ground. And within a few blocks of the shul, they bought a little house, or if they're lucky enough to have an apartment building, they bought a two-bedroom apartment to use on Shabbos. And that's the concept of a Shabbos house, and they say it began in Atlanta, Georgia. All right, so this is the thinking. Do I agree or disagree is unimportant. I suffer when I see a Jew starting a car on Shabbat. It troubles me to see someone drive, but these are great poskim. Yeshal mila smoke. We're not talking lightweights here. So that's what I would explain that psak and his whole approach. So innovative. You mean for good? He says, yeah, I mean for good. I see, because we liberal in South Africa, tens of thousands of Jews became Shomer Torah mitzvah. All right, you can't argue with that. Where do we differ than the conservative movement, which came up in class yesterday? All right, that's a delicate question. There's not a black and white answer. Obviously, we say it's usa. We wish it wouldn't be. The conservatives today take the approach, and it is very sad. There's an interview with Rabbi Risk, and I have to finish reading it, but I see already that so many things I disagree with. The reforming I had people who came out of Russia, Yomo, listen carefully, came out of white night, good people, they end up in Los Angeles. They wanted to become total Jews. But they were living far from the shul, hard to relocate. So they said to me, with Elichkeit, our rabbi says it's permissible to drive on Shabbos. Understand? No, go and argue. Go and tell them that guy's as much a rabbi as Mao Zedong, who was Masayim Shas at the last Masayim Shas in Shanghai. But you can't talk like that. You don't want to hurt them. But my rabbi, and I've heard this from more than one person, so there is a difference between Reb Moshe Sternbuch and the conservative rabbinate. Now, one other point, and I want to thank Talmud sent this to me, a sub-Talmud. Remember I said to you that the RCA, remember in my time already, they didn't want to accept private ordination. And we'll come back to private ordination later today. And I said, but I understand there's some private smichot they do accept. So I have a list here, approved private masmichim as of March 2016, the Rabbinical Council of America. And for instance, in America, if you have a private smicha from Rabbi Reuven Feinstein, from Rabbi Moshe Heinemann, from Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, from Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik of Chicago, they will accept it for membership in the RCA. There's a long list of Israeli private smicha, and I see here Rabbi Natan Greenberg of Bat Ayin. If I'm not mistaken, and I correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's a nephew of Yitz Greenberg. You follow? So it shows you Torah Chozeret Lachsan Yishalom. And Rav Natan Greenberg, his private smich is accepted. There are other names here. All people I know, Rav Simcha Cook of Rehovot, his name is listed here. So there are a few private smichot accepted, and I thank the people for that information. Let us roll.
Like I say, it's 90% joke. Your name is not on the list.
I never give. Why should I give a private smicha? No, I'll only give smicha.
Yeah,
I'll give smicha if you show me you got smicha from YU. Uh-huh. In other words, like Jesse Klausner, I gave him smicha.
So
he was collecting smicha. There's another Yoshua Rubin who got smicha from the rabbinate. Am I right? He got smicha besides my smicha. And when he came to me, he showed me he already had smicha, so I added another smicha.
You got a few.
Yeah, no, people I know, absolutely. Yosef Klausner, I'll tell you a funny story. I wrote out the smicha. He said, "Well, Rebbe, why don't you have it typed?" I looked at him. I said, "The whole value of a smicha is the personality. I treasure a letter from the Rav 1,000 times more than the smicha I got from him. Smicha was every idiot in the yeshiva got the same cloth. right? The Mashgiach, I have a personal written out smicha. All right, gentlemen, we finished Rabbi Young. We're ready to move into a new world, an interesting world, a world gone by, but so important to understand. And to me, this is a special mitzvah, because Rabbi Young was our teacher. Yitz will agree with me. He was a personality. There was a certain a veneer about him. As I said to you, you didn't call him Leo. You called him Rabbi Young. Remember the other rabbis, Rabbi Rosenzweig, whoever was speaking about it said, we never called him Leo. We always called him Rabbi Young. Rabbi Goldstein, the other rabbis called Herbert. I felt a particularly close kinship to him. He was, remember what I told you a year ago, a long time ago, that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had three Talmidim. He called one the Lamdin, one the Chacham, and one the Chassid. And of course, Rabbi Goldstein was the Chassid. There was something about him, a certain piety that emanated from him, and you could feel it. He wasn't the Lamdin like Rabbi Young. Rabbi Young already was the Lamdin. Rabbi Dr. Young, the person who translated Masechet Yuma. And Rabbi Lookstein was, of course, the Chacham. He could establish Ramaz. He had a way with words. He could handle multi-billionaire Balabatim. But Rabbi Goldstein was the Chassid. His years, 1890 to 1970. All right? To me, it's not a Richa German Tovim already. When you're 50, you think, oh, a guy lived to 80, it's a long life. But he had, Baruch Hashem, a long life by standards of those years. Now, what's a very quick biographical sketch of his life, and we'll come back to all stages of his life in much more detail. He was born on the east side of New York. And his father was a prominent member of the biggest shul on the east side, the Beit Medrash HaGadol. If I'm not mistaken, the Beit Medrash HaGadol is still open today, and there's a minyan, am I right, there's still a daily minyan there, the Beit Medrash HaGadol, on Norfolk Street. No, it's been closed, even that has been closed. So there's no minyan on the east side, Ludlow Street, there was wow. In my time, there was still a minyan there, Beis Medrash HaGadol.
The building collapsed, and then they had a fire.
So it's 10 years ago. All right, no wonder it didn't register with me, because I'm here 50 years. But I used to remember the Beis Medrash HaGadol. It was living history. And his father was a leading balabas there. What's very fascinating, that in the Beis Medrash HaGadol, Harry Fishel was the leading balabas. And here you have this kid, Goldstein, whose name was not Herbert. The given name was Samuel. We'll see why he gets Herbert. Samuel Goldstein, kid is born, kid has a Brit Milah. Who do you think is at his Brit Milah? Harry Fishel. Balabatim. Same shul. Kid has a bar mitzvah. All right, at the bar mitzvah, the kid speaks, the rabbi speaks, and the leading balabas speaks. Harry Fishel. Dov, why am I telling you this? Who does Herbert Goldstein marry? Who makes him, who gives him the ability to become her?
Harry Fishel's daughter.
Right? Harry Fishel's daughter, of course. So it's interesting. It's like I always tell you, I was at Avishai David's Brit. Here you have, a kid is born, Samuel Goldstein. Harry Fishel is at the Brit. Harry Fishel speaks at his bar mitzvah. And Herbert Goldstein's name lives on because he married the girl with the PhD. Papa has dough. And the truth is that a great deal of the money that he gave, he gave through Herbert Goldstein. He became, we'll see, of all the sons-in-law, he was the one who was closest to Harry Fishel. He was the rabbi. He wrote Harry Fishel's biography. Cynics call it Harry Fischel's autobiography, if you understand. But it doesn't matter. It's a very valuable book, 40 years of struggle for a principle. It came out a few years ago in a revised edition, a very important volume. Now, his life, and here you'll notice, everyone who writes about him stresses his education went to public school. You'll see his mother had tremendous influence. She was the flimmer in the family and insisted he have a private rabbeim already from age 6 on. He went for a year or so to yeshivat, the only yeshiva at the time, Eitz Chaim, on the Lower East Side, which ultimately morphs into where we're sitting, Yeshiva University. Very interestingly, you'll see, he couldn't stay at Eitz Chaim long. Yitzchak, would you care to guess why? He couldn't handle the Yiddish. His Yiddish was a very secondary language. Evidently, in his home, they spoke English, and that's something at that stage in our history. His home was Americanized. They spoke English. We'll see how much command he had of Yiddish, but I'll put it this way. I can speak a better Yiddish than Samuel Goldstein. So he didn't stay long. He went to a very prestigious high school, Townsend Harris High School. I don't know, I doubt if it exists today. Anyone recognize the name?
Yeah.
Still there? Yeah, where is it, Vic?
In Queens.
In Queens today.
My father was
there. But Townsend then was where? In Manhattan. Am I right? They didn't travel out to Queens. Who could get to Queens? Townsend, is it still a prestigious high school?
Yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable, because it's like Bronx Science, they tell me. I got into Bronx Science, you know, my parents were boasting, Bronx Science, and Kleinigkeit.
When my father was studying there, they organized, he organized, a Jewish student body club, and they organized a Jewish newspaper for the students.
Very nice, very nice, okay. And then he went to Columbia University, okay, Samuel Goldstein. And all along he has private tutors, and while at Columbia he goes to JTS, and he's a 1914 graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Rabbi Hertz was a contemporary of his, the chief rabbi of the British Empire. Now, whenever they write about Rabbi Goldstein's life, I'm now quoting to you from Wikipedia. So they write, he had rabbinic ordination both from Rabbi Shalom Elchanan Jaffe of Beit Medrash HaGadol and from the Jewish Theological Seminary. Fine. Let me quote to you from a guy named Rothkopf. Open up the Judaica. Take the article Goldstein Herbert S. And here too, you will see that Rothkopf says he graduated from Jerusalem in 1914, was also ordained by Rabbi Shalom Yaffa, Vice President of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. At the end of Rothkopf's piece on Herbert Goldstein, it's a column, despite the fact that he was a graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary, Goldstein was a strictly Orthodox rabbi belonging to the right wing of the English-speaking Orthodox rabbinate, and in this respect was unique. And you see what you're touching upon here, you talk about Rabbi Goldstein. Sure, when he studied at JTS, it was essentially an Orthodox institution. Who was teaching there? Who were the students? Marias, Drachman, who are we talking about? Hymanson.
They signed his ordination. I told you, my great uncle, right. My great uncle went to Yitzchak Elchanan, and he went to Columbia at night.
Right.
When they heard he was going to Columbia, they kicked him out of Yitzhak Ocha.
Right, and he went to JTS. And these are the people who signed the ordination.
Yeah, what do you call it?
Louis Ginsburg was an Eloi from Telz. I don't know who you're dealing with here. But you see, Rabbi Goldstein, as the decades went by, he felt very uncomfortable because we're going to come to this, I don't know if this term or next term, see, we're going to see that there's a certain happening here that is creating conservative Judaism. In other words, till 1920, 1925, it's very amorphous. It's like today in Israel, today in America, you have big tent called so-called Orthodox. You have all types that are part of the tent. You have left-wing, right-wing, centrist. Until the mid-20s, more or less it was an amorphous, large world of traditional or Orthodox Judaism, call it what you wish. What happens is there are forces at work, as we will see, that force the issue. And by the late 20s, the name conservative Judaism with a capital C is here to stay. And a person like Rabbi Goldstein felt very, very awkward. And he always stressed that he had smicha from Rabbi Shalom Yaffe. You follow? That to him, ultimately, is more important than JTS ordination. And this is why Rothkopf, in the article he writes for the Judaica, this article was written in 1969, so he goes out of his way. Despite the fact that he was a graduate of the Jewish Tantra, Goldstein was a strictly Orthodox rabbi. And you have to understand who you're dealing with. You're dealing with a person who felt very awkward. JTS graduate. Tell them that in 1914, no problem. Tell them that in 1924, no problem. Tell them that in 1934, when Mordechai Kaplan is the dominant figure at JTS, what are you, a JTS graduate? No, you're a nice fuff, a trumpenik. He was felt very awkward.
He also signed his ordination.
Mordechai, yeah, the whole faculty. He was part of the faculty. He was still from when was or considered from when you're. It's a great uncle or an uncle?
A great uncle.
When your great uncle graduated, he was still considered from. All right. Now, let me just very briefly.
When you say that he had a private theater from Rav Shalom Yaffe,
right?
Does this mean the man just wrote a piece, a document, or did he quiz it?
Well, I would put it this way: Rav Shalom Yaffe was a rav on the east side. There's no question that he knew the family. There's no question that he saw this kid grow up. So properly, when he presented a smicha from JTS, Yehudava Od, he added a private smicha. Now, a private smicha raises the question that we alluded to at the start of the class, will the RCA accept it? And here you see the RCA list, Reb Shalom Yaffe, I'm sure if he was giving smicha today, the RCA would accept it. So whether he quizzed him or questioned him again, Bakinet, I doubt. I think he knew that this man has done his best to study. He's a Yerei Shamayim. He'll make a good rabbi. He's a wonderful speaker. We're not going to worry. But it is said, and I'll give you the source later, it is said that when Reb Shalom Yaffe gave out these private smichot, he always added an addendum that the smicha is valid as long as this individual takes a shul that has a mechitza. But if chas v'chalila, he will acquiesce and take a shul that doesn't have a mechitza, I nullify and abrogate the smicha I am giving him.
Well,
Rabbi Rebel, I can tell you as a fact, declared someone a smichalis who took a mikshtela. You see, you're dealing with a period where every other Orthodox shul was taking down the machitza. You're dealing with a period where the kids were taking over the shul, the second generation Americans, the third generation Americans, and for them, this is what we spoke about with Rabbi Tao. This is exactly the storm that's broke now in our world here in Israel. How much of the Western world can you accept? And I'm positive Rabbi Shalom Yaffe gave him smicha, but the sources claim that there was this addendum, which he probably did with every rabbi. It's al tanai that you remain in the Torah camp, in the Orthodox camp. Now, let me go one step further, just to fill in the details of his life. While he was still at JTS, he was gaining a reputation as a good speaker. By this time, his family and official family moved to the Upper East Side. They were no longer on the Lower East Side. And Rabbi Margolis brought him in to Kehillat Jeshurun. And in Kehillat Jeshurun in 1914, 1915, perhaps 1916, for a number of years, you had three rabbis functioning. Ramaz, Rabbi Moshe Zvulun Margolis, was the revered rabbi. He spoke in Yiddish, the Balabatim revered him. The Balabatim had derech eretz for him. His personality was such that even the American-born kids of the second generation and the third generation, everyone revered the rabbi. It was, I would put it, it's like a Hasidic feeling or a Sfadic feeling that you see in Israel. Not every Sfadi is a tzaddik, but when he sees a Sfadic Rav, the derech eretz is overwhelming. Not every chassid is a tzaddik, but the chassid sees his Rebbe, there's a connection there. He will not say a word against the Rebbe. He'll put on an aura from kite. It's the Rebbe. That's the way they're related to Ramaz. Who is the second rabbi? The assistant rabbi, the English-speaking rabbi. That already was Mordechai Kaplan. What role did Rabbi Goldstein play? Rabbi Goldstein was the head of the Talmud Torah. He loved children. And I will come to I'm going to give you deep insight into him in a few minutes, but I just want to put the skeleton in front of you. This is his life. Well, he loved children. Children are tomorrow. Nothing brings me greater happiness than to see young people. There's now, they tell me, Rabbi Shai Finkelstein. And I see everyone raving about him. So I told my wife, you have no idea how much nachat I have. Why? Because it means there's a tomorrow. It means we've perpetuated ourselves. You understand what I'm saying? Rakefet, if I go and I speak, and there is a good, he gave it wonderful, to new big deal. Rakefet is on in years, but Shai Finkelstein is in his prime. What is he, in his 30s? I've yet to meet him to the best of my knowledge. He was many years in Memphis, Tennessee, and terrific. There's a tomorrow. Herbert Goldstein loved children. We have to influence. Well, the Upper East Side is a nice place, but that's wealthy Jews are there. There are not too many wealthy Jews. There are not too many children. What area was teeming with Jews and teeming with Yiddishkeit? Harlem. Harlem, where my parents were born, where my parents lived. My parents were neighbors. The shidduch was made many years later. My grandparents knew each other. They were, I think, door-to-door neighbors in a tenement in Harlem. 1917, he goes to Harlem. And in Harlem, he is very innovatively thinking, a lot like Mordechai Kaplan. We have to attract the kids to the shul full time. It has to be a community center. Where does it differ from a YMHA? A YMHA is everything but a shul. We have to build the shul, has to be the heart, but around the shul there have to be endless activities. A gymnasium, a swimming pool. In its prime in Harlem, the institutional synagogue that he founded, notice the name, institutional, it's an institute. It has everything. It's not just a synagogue. It's like, you might as well use the word, many institutions under one roof. At its high point, his Talmud Torah at the institutional synagogue, and this synagogue and all that went on it catered to 3,000 people a day. It had a roster of 67 clubs. Could you imagine what this man created? Jack, how many people go into the Shtiblach every day?
Well, over 1,000, could be 2,000.
All right, 3,000 people a day. And remember, the Shtiblach is just to daven. All right, you have some learning there.
Spread out.
You have some learning, you have a mikveh there. The Shtiblach is so small, it's such a disgrace that in Katamon, where there are Jews living who are wealthier than Rothschild, and they have that on the corner, the Shtiblach, they should buy up more property and build.
Yeah, Ernie tried.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work. All right? Now, but what happened? Changing neighborhoods. And here I have to say that Rothkopf could be arrested today. Seriously. Because he wrote in 69... after Harlem became a totally Negro neighborhood in the 1930s. Am I allowed to write that today? What would happen in Harlem, even if I write Afro-American neighborhood, isn't that putting them down? I don't know, Charlie. What we got to fine-tune this. But Negro? Wow. After Harlem became a totally Negro neighborhood in the 1930s, he transfers activities to the West Side. And that means he started on the West Side, mid-30s. First he went back and forth, Harlem to the West Side. It was walkable, wasn't the end of the world. And then he built a tremendous synagogue on the Upper West Side, a synagogue that still stands until today. And he used the same name, institutional, but to differentiate the West Side Institutional Synagogue. And that's, of course, where Rabbi Goldstein became famous pre-World War II, World War II, post-World War II, Reconstruction, all that went with it. Yes, Yitzchak?
Not that it's important, but Rabbi Philip Goodman, my father-in-law.
We got to give your father-in-law credit.
He was the assistant rabbi for Herbie S. Goldstein, and he stayed in Harlem.
He stayed in Harlem.
And he stayed in Harlem until 1940 when he moved to work at the JWB.
Right.
But he, and while he was there, he organized a summer camp for the kids, a day camp. He got Luigi Siegel to cater when the boys went to the camp. He got Luigi Siegel to cater when they went, he took them to the Yankee game.
Right. The youth. This was Goldstein's concept we're going to talk about.
And then even I have it at home, a cap.
Beautiful.
It said institutional synagogue.
Right. This we're going to talk about it in a minute. I just want to fill in the details. Now, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein has a distinction that no other rabbi has. He is the only person who is president of the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, the Rabbinical Council of America, and the Synagogue Council of America. And here you have to understand, right away you'll say, well, why did you call Herbert Goldstein so firm? Why is he called the Chassid? Synagogue Council of America. Glatt Reif. Not at that time. Synagogue Council of America becomes Treif in 1956. This is the shifting of American Orthodoxy. This is Reb Aaron Cutler. This is all that we've spoken about so many times. But in the 30s, the 40s, into the 50s, no one ever questioned belonging to synagogue council. It was natural. It was normal. The Reform and Conservative ruled the world. They were the large, powerful institutions. Join with them. Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik saw nothing wrong with it. As long as they don't issue halakhic decisions, absolutely nothing wrong with it. And he was president of all three institutions. No one else can make that statement. Well, at different times. We'll talk about how the RCA is organized. It's a shootout. It's a shoot-off from the Union of Orthodox Congregations. But what's the problem? Union of Orthodox Congregations, Rabbinical Council of America, Synagogue Council of America, and more than that, with the OU, his mind was always working towards the future. He deserves a lot of credit for perhaps organizing the OU. He was giving hashkacha on those crackers. Remember, sunshine crackers, whatever they're called. It was Rabbi Herbert Goldstein's hashkacha. And he came up with the idea that it shouldn't be a private rabbi. It should be an organization, non-profit. He was one of the godfathers of the OU. More than that, he cared about the youth. And he already had visions of reaching out to the youth through the OU, forerunner of national, of what we call today, a precursor for the National Council of Synagogue Youth, NCSY. More than that, he's one of the godfathers of another organization, which I don't believe exists today, but was quite powerful in the 60s, into the 70s, into the early 80s, Yavna. Remember what Yavna was? A branch of the OU that dealt with collegiate students who wanted to be from on campus. And Yavna was quite an organization. Reb Aaron Soloveitchik gave some of his most famous addresses for Yavna. And all this was Herbert Goldstein with a mind that went way beyond today, but saw what we have to do for tomorrow. Now, let me start giving some sources, and then I'm going to give you a living description of Herbert Goldstein. Rabbi Goldstein had a son-in-law. Knew anyone can tell me? Rabbi Rachel. Rabbi Rachel was a graduate of Yeshiva University. He succeeds his father-in-law as the rabbi of the West Side Institutional Synagogue. Rabbi Rachel has a son, Aaron Rachel, who has written the book about his grandfather, the Maverick Rabbi. It's a very dedicated, wonderful family. Rabbi Aaron Rachel quotes a fourth generation, a great-grandson of Harry Fischel, Rabbi Hillel Rachel. And these are just some of the little stories he talks about. Let's come back to Harry Fischel. Harry Fischel was self-made. You all know the story with Harry Fischel. He came to America impoverished. He came to America. He's met at Ellis Island. His cousin sees the kippah on his head, and he tells him, take it off. The kippah doesn't belong in America. Harry Fischel couldn't find a job. He didn't show up on Shabbos. They told him, don't come back on Monday. Harry Fischel finally decides he'll have to be Mechallel Shabbos. He has no choice. And he goes to this early 6 o'clock or 6:30 minyan, where everyone goes to work afterwards, goes home, makes kiddush, changes his clothes, and he starts out going to work. And as he's walking towards his job, he's walking on Norfolk Street, and there he sees people going to shul on Shabbos, and it reminds him of his parents and his grandparents and the way they look. And he turns home, and he makes up his mind never to be mechallel Shabbos. And as they say, the rest is history. More than that, you should know that you can see this until today. Once one to look it at, you can get the address from the book 40 Years of Struggle for a Principle. He built a building on the Upper East Side, which he lived on the second floor. Do you know about this? And on the second floor, there's one room where nothing is built on top of it. He lost, by today's standards, millions of dollars of rent a year. Why was nothing built on top of this room? That was his sukkah. That was his sukkah. He had a removable roof that he could retract the roof. That was his sukkah. This was Harry Fishel. So, Harry Fishel had four sons-in-law. One, a respected doctor. One, a leading lawyer. One, a successful businessman. And one, Rabbi Goldstein, a dynamic, idealistic rabbi. Rabbi Goldstein served as Mr. Fishel's right hand, guiding him in his spiritual endeavors. And everything that Harry Fishel did, once Rabbi Goldstein became his son-in-law, Rabbi Goldstein was the person who did it. Now, this was a beautiful shidduch, because it wasn't just a father-in-law and a son-in-law. Rabbi Goldstein's wife, the daughter of Harry Fishel, she shared with her husband the devotion, the dedication, the zeal. It was a perfect, perfect shidduch. Some of the stories about Harry Fishel are legendary. Visited Europe a number of times, visited his parents' graves. You can see pictures in 40 Years of Struggle for a Principle. And he went to see the Chafetz Chaim in Rotten. Chafetz Chaim welcomed him royally, dressing in Shabbos clothes in his honor, and sending a wagon of students to meet him at the entrance of the town. At the end of the visit, the Chafetz Chaim presented him with a signed copy of one of his Sfarim, emphasizing it was meant as a personal gift, Shelo al menat lekabel pras. This book is in the official Goldstein family until today. It's one story. Fine. Signed copy. You know why this speaks to me? Let me tell you a little story. One of the great skuyot and privileges in my life is that I taught together with Nechama Leibovich. We became very friendly. I would say even close. To know Nechama was to know greatness of greatness, one of a kind. So as her books finally came out from the Jewish agency on Parshat HaShavua, I would ask her to sign them for my daughters. And she would say to me, Ah, Merkayim kamocha zaminig America mazal achtom. And I want to tell you, she was wrong. When you have a book that's signed by the author, imagine to have a sefer signed by the Chafetz Chaim. It adds. Then there's the famous story that they tell the story, and they tell a wealthy person from America. I've heard the story told and retold. I've seen it in every Haredi newspaper. Gentlemen and lady, it's Harry Fishel we're talking about. No, what's the story? Harry Fishel was appalled at the Chafetz Chaim's furniture. Did you ever go to Rabbi Steinman's apartment? Do you see the way Rabbi Steinman lives? The people couldn't believe that the person who was the greatest person in the Degel HaTorah world lived with furniture that was from the Middle Ages. So Mr. Fishel pleaded with the Chafetz Chaim, let me buy you furniture. Let me refurnish the apartment. Chafetz Chaim refused. The famous story he told Harry Fishel, when you travel, do you have all the luxuries you have at home? And Harry Fishel said, no, you stay in a hotel. Whatever you have, but it's not like your home on the Upper East Side. So the Chafetz Chaim told Harry Fishel, I'm traveling. This is not the real world. The real world is Olam Haba. In this world, I'm traveling. I'm here for a short while. I don't need the luxury. I'll have it in an Olam Haba. Refused to accept any money. But here is something I didn't know. And I thank Hillel Reichel for telling me the story, because it's very meaningful to me. At that time, the Chafetz Chaim's daughter was getting engaged. This is a daughter from her second, from his second wife. Who was she getting engaged to? Reb Menachem Mendel Zaks. And Reb Menachem Mendel Zaks was a poor yeshiva boy, a Talmud in Ratten, a Bucky in Shas. I knew, oh God, these are real people to me. Reb Zaks is sitting right here. And he didn't have money to buy the girl a ring. So Harry Fishel said he will buy the jewelry so that Reb Menachem Mendel Zaks can give the girl a proper engagement gift. And this the Chafetz Chaim accepted, and Harry Fishel was responsible for the engagement gift that Reb Menachem Mendel Zaks gave to the Chafetz Chaim's daughter. I knew these people personally. Now, something else about Harry Fishel that every Israeli knows, knew you tell me, everyone in Merkaz Harav, he saw Chief Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, world famous, had just visited America, and look at the hovel he's living in. And he built Rav Cook the beautiful apartment on Rehov Rav Cook in the center of Jerusalem. That's the building that's been refurbished. There was a big fight over it, who it belongs to recently. Like everything else in life, we Jews have a knack. From Jews have a knack. It's been said more than once that all that we transferred from Bayit Sheni to contemporary life is Sinat Chinam, right? The Gemara talks about the Sinat Chinam. So Baruch Hashem, that we have. He built that building. That's Harry Fishel. But Harry Fishel was a Moiki Rabbanan. You understand? He didn't look who, Mizrahi, not Mizrahi, two famous Rabbanim, Rabbi Cook and Rabbi Zonnenfeld. He saw where Rabbi Chaim Yosef Zonnenfeld lives. Yosef, they're talking about the Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld. He went to visit him. Ah, a tiny semi-basement in the Jewish quarter of the old city. He said to Rav Zonnenfeld, let me build you a house like I built for Chief Rabbi Cook. Rabbi Zonnenfeld said, let me think about it. Then he declined the offer. Charlie, do you know why? From his little basement apartment, when he stepped outside, he had a view of Har HaZeitim. And he was able to be Maharher B'tshuva every day as he was reminded of the Yom HaMitah. And wow, what a magnificent story, Reb Chaim Yosef Zonnenfeld. But what a magnificent understanding of who Harry Fishel was, and how fortunate for us that this shidduch was made between his daughter and this young graduate of the seminary, Herbert Samuel Goldstein. Okay. Who was Rabbi Goldstein? Fine. We described the skeleton. We outlined his bones. He outlined his life. But who was he? How would you describe him? And here I want to tell you, I had the privilege to know someone very intimately for many, many decades. His name, Victor Geller. Recognize the name, or it's already a name gone by? It's not that long ago that he died, but like everyone else in life, he was in his 90s already, incapacitated, couldn't see. What an individual. Vic scanned the yeshiva from the 1930s until the day he died. He never had smicha from the yeshiva. He wound up in the American Army, fought in World War II. I think he already was a college graduate at the time. I may be wrong. Can read his autobiography. And very, very insightful. He worked in community service division. He established many congregations, later went into private business, ran tours. A very fascinating individual. He left a memoir, Orthodoxy Awakens, The Belkin Era and Yeshiva University. This volume was published in 2003 by Urim here in Israel. And beginning with chapter 3, page 42, he has a very insightful description of who Herbert Goldstein was. This was a period when no one thought there was a future for Torah in the United States. The Rev repeated time and again, the Balabatim he had to deal with, many of them were Shomrei Shabbat and Shomrei Kashrut and Shomrei Tarat Mishpacha, but they had no vision of tomorrow. Their attitude was, Judaism dies with us. Our kids are not interested, the grandchildren couldn't care less, there'll be nothing here tomorrow. In the 1910s, the 1920s, Reform had conquered the entire world of the original American immigrants. Show me outside of one or two German Jewish families that were not Reform Jews. Temple Emanuel, the most prestigious synagogue in the United States. By the 1920s, conservative Judaism is conquering every other little Orthodox or big Orthodox shul. Take the mechitza down, the influence of the modern world, suffragettes, women have a right to vote. Why do we have to be imprisoned behind a big mechitza in the synagogue? No one thought there would be a tomorrow. Rabbi Herbert Goldstein, I'm quoting Vickeller, one of the few individuals that had confidence there could be a great tomorrow. Now, how did he do it? And here Vickeller used one name. Do you know Steve Riskin? I'm quoting Vickeller now. Rabbi Goldstein was the Rabbi Riskin in the 1910s and the 1920s. It's a very insightful quote. Rabbi Goldstein, he was with the kids. He could play basketball with them. He could run up and down the court with them. He was one of the boys. He could use baseball language in the middle of a sermon. I'll give you an example later. What he did, revolutionary. Vision. But everything based upon commitment to Torah and mitzvot. I'm quoting Vic now. He studied at JTS. Chief Rabbi Herzog was a classmate. Went on a precedent-setting career. The institutional synagogue in Harlem, the center of Jewish life at this time. On Sunday mornings, Goldstein gathered young men and women and led them on a parade along fashionable Lenox Avenue, the main thoroughfare of Jewish Harlem. Could you imagine? Can you view the sight? The anxious immigrant parents of these young people, though personally not religious, followed these parades seeking to learn more about the mysterious missionary figure trying to convert their children. The parade ended in a movie theater that the rabbi had rented. To the assembled audience, Goldstein would present Torah with passion and persuasion. His listeners were taken with both the man and the message. He had made Judaism a marketable commodity. I'll go further here in a second. Does this remind you of anything I said a number of years ago? See, you take Rabbi Goldstein. See what he did. Confidence in tomorrow. Marching up and down Lenox Avenue. I want to go to Crown Heights, Brooklyn. The early 40s, Crown Heights, teeming with Jews, tens and tens of thousands, if not that whole area, greater area, unbelievable amount of Jews, synagogues, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, not yet Rebbe, What was one of the first things he did? Tashlich, Rosh Hashanah, the big botanical gardens, not that far from 770. His father-in-law already was incapacitated, but the young Rebbe took the Hasidim, and maybe there were a few hundred that gathered around the shtibel on Rosh Hashanah, and he insisted they march to Tashlich b'fnei Am Ve'edah. And when you read, they're watching them, Eastern Parkway. Think what I'm telling you. Eastern Parkway, 770 is over there. You march up to Botanical Gardens, right off Eastern Parkway, the center of Brooklyn, the height of Brooklyn, the memorial to the First World War on that side, tremendous library on the other side, Botanical Gardens with the lake in it and all that goes with it. And you have memoir literature. Rabbi Zalman Posner of Nashville, Tennessee, Zichrono Livracha, writes that he was a kid from a typical American home. And he saw these Jews marching on Rosh Hashanah. Let me march with them. Let me see what it's about. And he said, it converted him. It brought him into Yiddishkeit. Brought him into Chabad. Others, a man, a youngster, pride, marching, publicly displaying, we are Jews. We're proud to be Jews. Lubavitcher Rebbe. Go back 20 years. There you have Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. Harlem. Lenox Avenue. Big thoroughfare. When I say Lenox Avenue, it's like talking about marching on Fifth Avenue. It's like marching here on King George, or marching in Tel Aviv on Ben Yehuda. It's the heart, the center. But Vic goes further. And remember, this is an eyewitness speaking. Rabbi Goldstein did not limit his role to the pulpit. He was a regular participant in the basketball games that the young Sunday marchers played in the synagogue's gym. He had no hesitation racing down the court with his tzitzit, ritual fringes, flying. It was just one of the lessons that Rabbi Goldstein displayed. So successful was he that at his peak his Talmud Torah in Harlem had an enrollment of 900 youngsters. Just think what we're talking about. Let me talk about basketball court. Charlie, when you went to Kol Torah, did the Rebbeim play basketball with the boys? Do you know who deserves the credit for what's changed so particularly in the Tzionidati world? I can't say the Haredi world. Americans came to Israel, Rabbi Avram Silbert, Be'er Sheva, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. They were basketball players. They weren't ashamed to show they were normal human beings. That sports can be helpful. Rav Kook writes about this, the importance of coming back to total human expression. But you had a revolution here. When I came in Aliyah, I can never forget the story with Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, he had just started in the Gush, and there was a kid in BMT who grew up in Crown Heights. This kid had some of the same Rebbeim that Rabbi Aaron had in Crown Heights Yeshiva. So the kid spent the Shabbos in the Yeshiva, and he with Rabbi Aaron, they had a field. You remember this teacher, that teacher, talking about their teachers, their experience. They were 10, 15 years apart. And at the end of Shabbat, after Havdalah, the kid went over to Rabbi Aaron to wish him a Shavua Tov. And the older kids pushed the kid and said, who are you? Mi atala da bema Rosh Yeshiva? Lo nigashim kacha Rosh Yeshiva. Go into Panovich. Don't know today, but that was the Nohag in Panovich as well. A newcomer, you didn't go near the Rosh Yeshiva. You didn't go near. You tzitted, you shook, you shake. It's the famous story with the kid Yitzchak Greenbaum, the 1980 story that made headlines in every Israeli newspaper. When Yitzchak Greenbaum started in Panovich, so the word went out who he was. So they said, we're going to take you to the Rosh Hashiva. And I say, look, how can I talk? Your case is different. Follow? His case was different. You know what I'm talking about? The Rosh Hashiva said, the son went to, came to Rav Shach. Rebbe, yesh lanu tamid chadash, kedai sheh Rosh Hashiva yifgosh oto. And the Rosh Hashiva looked up, there's the Talmud. He spoke Hebrew until he got excited. When he got excited, he broke into Yiddish, Rav Shach. And they brought the Talmud over. And he says, Eich kodim lecha? And the Talmud said, Yitzchak Greenbaum, Yitzchak, do you remember the Rav used to talk about Yitzchak Greenbaum? The Rav knew him from Warsaw. The Rav had admiration for him. He was a very honest person, although far, far from Torah. And the kid says, Shmi, he says, in a low voice, Yitzchak Greenbaum. And Rav Shach says, Aneinikel? And the kid says, King. And Rav Shach started to cry. And he thanked the people for bringing him over to Rav Shach. Made all the newspapers here. The Americans had a big influence that Kavod HaRav doesn't mean to establish a distance. We saw it with the Rav, although we didn't appreciate it enough. The Rav later, if you read Rakefet's work, the second volume, where Rakefet quotes the Rav word by word, where the RCA is honoring the Rav. This is already in the early 80s, perhaps, late 70s. Look it up. Rabbi Schoenfeld has just spoken. And the Rav says, I don't know if I deserve to be honored. You should be honored for being my students. And he went on that a Rebbe only achieves when he has students. And he says, my students are my pals. Remember that? That if you think you're brighter than your students and smarter than your students, you cannot succeed. But if you look upon your students as your friends, your colleagues, your pals, I've said, then you can succeed. And you're my pals. Beautiful, beautiful thought. And this is Rabbi Goldstein. This is a beautiful, beautiful description. Now, what he did for the men, Mrs. Goldstein or Rebbetzin Goldstein took an active part in her husband's work. She organized the young women of the community. They found a welcome place in the Torah society that the new synagogue represented. And here Vic says something very personable, very personal, that I can appreciate, maybe some of you. Did you know his wife, Henya? Henya. How did Vic meet Henya? Henya was a frum girl growing up in Manhattan. A frum girl. How is Henya frum? And Vic explains, the new synagogue, decades later, my mother-in-law, this is Henya's mother, would proudly describe herself as, quote, one of the institutional synagogue girls, end quote. In other words, these people were so proud. They were part of something. They were part of something big. They were part of something that was in consonance with Torah. There was no rebellion, and yet they were part and parcel of the American scene. And I think Vic Skeller's description is absolutely perfect. When we met Rabbi Goldstein, he already was on in years. He was revered. When Yitz Rubin walked into class and saw Rabbi Goldstein, he shook a little. Oh, what a privilege it is to study with this man. But here he is in his youth, running up and down the basketball court with his tzitzis swinging in the air. And let me go one step further and we'll come back to a continuation of the basketball court, but move it to the polygrams. By the way, how Vic met Henya, they were both New York Giant fans. And therein is the story. Excuse me. Therein is the story that no one sitting in this classroom who grew up in Kiev in the Ukraine will understand, or even those who grew up in the greater Toronto area. New York had three baseball teams. Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Dodgers, the legendary Brooklyn Dodgers. So many Jews in Brooklyn, they loved the Dodgers. You all know that. The New York Yankees, the heart of the Bronx, shuls all over the place. Rav Heschel Schechter grew up a few blocks from Yankee Stadium. They called it Yankel Stadium. The New York Yankees, I need not tell you, the shoes were shaking in the Mount Eden area when DiMaggio hit a home run. So many Jews were swept away by the Yankees. For some reason, the New York Giants, the Polar Grounds, that at one time in their starting lineup in the 1930s, the late 30s, fielded four different Jews. A pitcher, a catcher, an outfielder, a second baseman. The New York Giants, whatever the reason, Manhattan didn't attract the Jews the way the Dodgers did and the way the Yankees did. When I went to school, when I went to yeshiva, I entered YU 1951, you were either a Yankee fan or a Dodger fan. I don't recall one kid rooting for the New York Giants. And Vic and Hanya were both New York Giant fans. That's how they met. So put that into the anecdotal histories of Torah in the United States. Now, let me begin. I won't finish. What we have about Rabbi Goldstein's life, a very fascinating volume. I believe it's been printed twice. The Maverick Rabbi. Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein and the Institutional Synagogue, a new organizational form. Aaron Ira Shelitz, his grandson, J.D., meaning he's a lawyer. I'm quoting to you, beginning on page 27. He writes about his birth, the Brit Mila, Harry Fisher present, and about his name. His original name given at his Brit Mila was Shmuel. What happened was later in life, before, at the end of his early years, he doesn't give the exact date, but when he was a teenager, it must be 13, 14, he was stricken by an acute attack of appendicitis. I need not tell you that life was more dangerous then. Medicine was not as developed as today. And there's an old minhag, dure dorot, when someone is ill, about to undergo an operation, they add a name. Generally, you add a name like Raphael, like Chaim. You add a name that the person, God should be kind, and survive the operation and go on to Chaim Raphael. Raphael, a name of that indication. Chaya, etc. So they added the name Chaim. When they added the name Chaim, they needed an English equivalent. So for Chaim, they chose Herbert. And the Herbert caught on. Sometimes you see people with an added name, it's only when they call to the Torah. But here in this case, Chaim caught on, and the S became no more than Herbert S. Goldstein. The young rabbi was closest to his brother Emmanuel, who was older, and he always referred to him as Manny. The two slept in one room and shared a common appreciation of the game of baseball. And here there's a long footnote. Now you have to understand, we mentioned it yesterday at the end of class with the freebies, baseball today is not the attraction it used to be. Tremendous problem. Some of the Afro-Americans are very capable in sports, and they choose basketball over baseball. This was something unheard of 100 years ago. Rabbi Schechter, Solomon Schechter of JTS, at one of the early graduations, said to the graduating rabbis and giving them a charge, and this is recorded, this is not anecdotal, this is factual. He said to them, and let me advise you, if you want to be successful rabbis in America, you must know baseball. That is the language with which you can speak to the youth. End quote. So he became a baseball fan, and in the footnote he describes, later in life, as a rabbi, Goldstein was able to endear himself to many of his youthful followers by peppering his language in an assortment of anecdotes with occasional references to this sport. And then he gives a beautiful example. When he would notice some young people about to leave the synagogue before the service was completely over, he might quietly say to them, "Would you leave a baseball game before the last out?" When he would overhear some boys talking about baseball during the service, he would gently remind them what that they were in a synagogue and why they were there. And then with a friendly wink add, quote, "Besides, you're rooting for the wrong team." No, gentlemen, can anyone tell me when Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Rav Soloveitchik used a baseball just as Rabbi Herbert Goldstein in front of an audience of thousands in the mid-70s? No, Dove, were you there? It was the Tanya Soloveitchik Memorial Lecture, and the Rav was speaking about the Haggadah. And the first point the Rav made, why do we use as the text for the Haggadah the whole Vidui Bikurim? Aram Yovei Davi and the whole story, we went down to Egypt and God redeemed us and now we came to this land. Why are we using that text? Should use something from Shmod, the actual Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim. And the Rav developed an idea of Hakarat HaTov, that Vidui Bikurim, Hakarat HaTov. And the Rav sensed the audience, it was college kids, boys, girls, yeshiva college, Stern college, outsiders. He sensed the audience didn't entirely understand the depth of what he was saying. And he said to them, "Don't worry, I'm just warming up now." And boy, the audience broke into such laughter, the Rav just warming up. But this is a fabulous comment. It shows these people were integrated. They knew who they were talking to. They knew who their audience was. All right, and let me make one more point to validate something I said an hour ago. His mother was very upset that he's starting public school. There's no yeshiva. She wants him to get proper training. And evidently, it was a well-to-do home. They weren't like Harry Fishel, but they didn't lack for money. She insisted that his father engage a private tutor. And who do you think one of his early instructors was? Was the father of Rabbi Abba Hillel Silva. In other words, Rabbi Abba Hillel Silva, great Reformed rabbi, great orator, great Zionist leader. His father was a Frum Yid on the Lower East Side, and he was one of the early Melamdin, a house Melamed of Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. Spent a little time in the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary's predecessor, known as Eitz Chaim, but now they quote Rabbi Goldstein himself. "Somehow or other, I didn't make it well. The Yiddish was not the Yiddish that I can translate into English." And his grandson writes, "In fact, Yiddish was never one of his strong points. Although he could communicate in this language, the Yiddish he could communicate in was more German, with which he was more colloquially familiar with, than the Yiddish of Yeshivas Rebbe Yitzchok Chanan. And that too is a very interesting point. You take Rabbi Young. Rabbi Young had a great command of languages, but that may be a born skill. He's Hungarian, German, Yiddish, English, Greek and Latin if need be, PhD. Rabbi Lookstein's native language was Yiddish. So there was no question he was equally at home in Yiddish and English. But Rabbi Goldstein, Lower East Side, moving to the Upper East Side, and his whole upbringing, he already was a kid totally at home in English, baseball, the street scene, the reality of the New World, the reality of New York, and Yiddish was a language already that he was not at ease with. It's very, very interesting. Also interesting that by the time the institutional synagogue was organized, the generations he was dealing with did not need Yiddish, did not want Yiddish. They were kids, American kids, second generation, third generation. In his case, Yiddish was not necessary. And it carries over. I don't have to tell you today in the United States of America who speaks Yiddish, which rabbi, who would ever dream the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas, Rav Yitzchak Lichtenstein Shlita, who I remember him as a gleam in his parents' eyes. And here is Yitzi Rosh Yeshiva giving the inaugural shir in Torah Vadas. And occasionally he broke into some Yiddish, Litvish Yiddish, Hashene Yiddish, Hageshmak in Yiddish, but the shir was in English. Comes to Los Angeles, what was it, a few weeks ago, it's all online, total English. You don't hear a word of Yiddish. Agudat Yisrael, their main sessions, what were they in? Their annual convention. Yiddish, English? I believe it has to be English. I can't believe they can get away today trying to influence thousands of American kids with Yiddish. So you see, when Rakefa Granson raves, sometimes he's so stupid, it's unbelievable that he says, Torah was destroyed in America September of 1960 when Danny Greer got the Rav to switch into English. Rakefa, right or wrong, Charlie, it was inevitable. Nevertheless, I think Rakefa was right. Okay? That's an opinion. Take it both ways. I contradict myself, so may it be. But that's what happened. By the way, I want you to know, my description of how the Rav switched to English is absolutely accurate. I was sitting right here. I heard every word. Because people tell stories. I heard a story the other day that the Rav made a survey in class. Is English better? Yiddish? I looked at them. Who told you that? I said, you tell him in my name, it's not so. I was sitting there. And that's the story. But this is Rabbi Goldstein. And let me end off. The book continues. The article continues. Bar mitzvah. Beautiful event. Everyone attends. Who are the speakers? The rabbi and Harry Fishel. So you see, there was divine guidance here. And this was a shidduch, second only to the Rabbi Revel shidduch. You follow? Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Moshe Bick said to me, I'll never forget, I see the shine in his eyes. He said, yes, the shidduch was gemacht in America. The first real shidduch made in America was Rabbi Bernard Revel, the young Gaon from Europe, to the young Sarah Chaya Revel from Marietta, Ohio. Rabbi Shimon Zivitz proposed the shidduch. He was from Pittsburgh. He traveled to Marietta. They didn't have a resident rabbi there. He was there every few weeks. He heard from Rabbi Leventhal about Rabbi Bernard Revel, who was living with him, this young man from Europe, getting his degrees in Philadelphia. and assisting him in the rabbinate, he made the shidduch, and out of that shidduch came Yeshiva University. Everything that comes afterwards, the Travis family enabled him to take the position, not take a salary. They put money into the yeshiva, the 1910s, the 1920s. All right, then they go bankrupt, and believe me, Rabbi Revel suffers not having the Travis family able to keep the yeshiva afloat. But here you have Rabbi Goldstein, unbelievable, at his Brit Milah, Harry Fishel, at his Bar Mitzvah, Harry Fishel. Rabbi Fishel, here they describe the whole speech, the rabbi, Harry Fishel, that he should be a good kid and he should continue and Zolgein on a Yiddish Veg and a Yiddish Derech. And here's this Herbert S. Goldstein, Herbert Samuel Goldstein, shaking his head affirmatively. And take a look what this young man will go on to do. So to reiterate, we're not finished, we're beginning. But you're getting a feel, you're getting a taste. We're creating an American rabbinate, an American Orthodox rabbinate. Many Balabatim thought there was no tomorrow. Many Balabatim thought we got to give up the battle. Many Balabatim raised their hands, my grandparents among them. I always asked my father, how could your mother, your father, my mom is given a tzaddeket, my grandmother was a tzaddeket. We have living testimony yet about her from other members of the family. And how could they tolerate your growing up and no Yiddishkeit and no knowledge and no this? And he quoted his mother saying, I quote, I heard this quote many times, quote, his mother is saying, the Ribbono Shel Olam takes care of so many goyim, so many non-Jews, she'll take care, he'll take care of my son as well. All right, that's a quote, raising your hands, giving up the battle. But all right, I can understand, they were overwhelmed, they were greenhorns, what did they know, what could they do, lack of education, lack of language. But here you have a man who didn't give up. And the most important part of today's Sheyur is the image of him marching up Lenox Avenue with these kids. By the way, Yitzchak, with hats, like the hat you have. Every kid was given a free hat to participate in the march.
It was like
an army. No, he knew what he was doing. And then to take the theater and then go back and play basketball. Wow, it's a new tomorrow. Remember, would you leave before the game is over, before the last out? Wow, the Rebbe's in our world. He knows about baseball, knows about the last out. What a fabulous, insightful description by Vic Geller. All right, the family volume, the Maverick Rabbi, gives a lot of information and deals with his life, his commitments, the difficulties, the challenges. But Baruch Hashem, the name Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, and of course the name Harry Fishel, these names live on in great dignity. All right, now the freebies. I want to mention, I can't believe it, I said yesterday about the article, I think, Ethel, you took that article by Rabbi Town?
Yes.
Okay, hold on to it for a while, I may need it. Here, take a look at the paper. This is the front page of Makor Rishon. This is Rabbi Town. And Harav Tau Korei Lemeri Ezrachi Neged Shetef Arachim HaChadashim. They have to rebel against this brainwashing of the so-called Western world. Lou Rockefeller's been yelling this and shouting this. But Rabbi Tao is Rabbi Tao. He has a following. People are listening. And he's been attacked already. That's what I was told this morning. And I got to see, how can they attack him? Etty, hold on to this with the other... Oh, you have Makarov? Say the front page Makarov Shon. Yeah, good, okay. Then I gotta show you the absolute chutzpah. This is a full page ad for a rabbinate that is now open. And by the way, someone from the Kollel should apply in Caesarea. You've heard of Caesarea?
Yeah.
Not poor Jews living there. That much. The prime minister is there right now. Here it says Caesarea's, I see it. Okay, but all right, Caesarea. Here, they announced they're looking for a rabbi. Description of what they have to do. It is an Orthodox religious Zionist kehila with many different members who have many different hashkafas and speak many different languages. What does the rabbi have to do? Hagdarat tafkid. He has to be there for all religious events, for all life cycles, weddings, funerals, memorials, Shabbat and Chagim. Has to give drashot, shirei Torah for all age and all levels, for women, men, and children. He has to answer halachic shaylas. Listen carefully. He has to be in shul every day, shachrit, milchan, marav. He has to be a shliach tzibur at times on the holidays. He has to be a bal korei if there's no one else. He has to prepare kids for Shabbos. He has to check the Erev. He has to expand the kehila and get new families. In order to fill this role, we need a rabbi Talmud Chacham who can be posek halacha. He needs smicha and kosher rabbanut to be a rav moshav. He has to speak well and look decently and know how to dress. He has to know how to give proper drushes filled with contents that are appropriate. He has to have been in the army, either Sheirut, Tzava, Malei, or Chesda. He has to have had experience as a Rav and a Kehila. Hebrew has to be his main language, his Sfatein. But he has to know English on a very high level. He has to live in Caesarea, or if he can't afford it, Or Akiva, which is across the highway. He can only get killed crossing that highway on Shabbos. What else? He has to know halacha, and he has to be a decent person and charismatic and how to speak to people and feel a sense of service and a sense of vision. Truthful, a person that inculcates belief and people will believe him. He has to be charitz v'achrayi. And the final word, the hekef ha-misra. How much of a job? Misra chelkit. Part-time job. I want to tell the balabatim in Caesarea, if I see any of you, I'm going to wash your faces in mud. You are a disgrace to the rabbinate. What he called it? Then Mikarishon. Mikarishon. And this is Caesarea. That's so up hit, and I couldn't believe it. Enjoy it. Vic, this is for you. A follow up to yesterday. Two things on Rabbi Soloveitchik, on the Soloveitchik family. You can keep it and take it. This is unbelievable. Come close. This is the Pashkana Rebbe fearing Atish. Look at, you know what I'm talking about? This is Tata Luf, the Tzva Haganah Yisrael, Rebbe Hosea Friedman, the son of Rebbe Yisrael Friedman. Remember, I told you all about him. Here he is. Take a look at the crowd. And take a look at the kippot on their heads. So it shows you Chassidus is alive and kicking. And here's a man, for the first time in history, a brigadier general is a Hasidic Rebbe. If you look at the shtreimel he's wearing, that is a Rishonish shtreimel, a perfect Rishonish shtreimel. Here is one of the most beautiful.
Good thing you can buy it in Israel. You
know, the lot law, but not yet. Here is something beautiful. Again, I cry easily, but any Jew who doesn't cry, and I have a share in this, Reb Yitzhak Kogan, who I first met in Leningrad in 1981. Reb Yitzhak Kogan, he's now in Moscow, in a wealthy synagogue, which he built from the ground. His shul donated a Torah to the shul established in Tel Aviv by the Lo Aleinu, the Rav who was killed by the terrorists up north, Rabbi Ahiad Ettinger, right? Remember a few months ago, weeks ago, beautiful, beautiful article. And there's Yitzchak, came in with his family from Moscow for the dedication. gave the Torah. You don't realize.
I don't believe that.
From Moscow giving it, right? Giving to you, beautiful, beautiful. Right. And here's an article from a man who had been mayor of Kiryat Ono, how Kiryat Ono got to have a shul and a school for religious kids. Beautiful story. His kid became frum, and he was in America, and he went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he told the Rebbe, my son wants a religious school. We have none in Kiryat Ono. The Rebbe said, I will pay for the school.
No
kidding. Yeah, you got to read that. Unbelievable. What the Rebbe, what a man. Just a shame they have to, the Messianics, in this memory. Here's a whole picture of smicha. They're giving at Chabad, they're getting smicha, a big celebration. Take a look how many, and they're writing and they're signing. The trouble is they don't identify names with the pictures. That would be very interesting. But a big simcha. This is a very interesting article. Hadassah Chaim is a woman, evidently a Chabadniket from Italy, living in Israel. And she gets a call from Russia that they want to arrange something in Rome, the great synagogue of Rome, for a group of 800 Russian kids coming to visit. And she said, well, how can I do that? No, you have to do it. You know the Italian language. You know, it's like asking me to go back to the Bronx, let's say, the Bronx, Riverdale today. And she accomplishes it. Beautiful, beautiful story. Here is the anti-vaccine rally. This is a Chilul Hashem Shein Dugmato. They had a big rally, and most of the participants against the vaccine are what the press calls ultra-Orthodox Jews. Hard to understand it, that's all I can say. This is about Rashid Talibab, whatever her name is. The whole talk that she gave, she's calm that the Arabs let the Jews into Israel, and no Democrat came out and corrected her. That's what's shocking to me. This is unbelievable what you can find on the internet. Chaim Schnitzer found that what is Yeshiva Salanta in 1923 in Harlem had a Siyum Mishnayot, and they spoke Hebrew. Davharovitz had geret Hebrew, and the Gespilt Afidl, one of the professors who teach there, played a fiddle, a gespilt fiddle at the Siyum. I can't believe it, my alma mater. Anyone interested, a review of the book that everyone is talking about, Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky, Flowers in the Desert. It's about how the five towns got off the floor as the center of Torah. Here are more reviews, including the famous book that a new edition came out in, How to Make Brachas. You're familiar with this? Look, I've seen it, looked at it, and boy, I feel I'm lacking. This reviewer says, and this is Gil Student, my dear colleague, and Gil says, if he doesn't know how you can live without this book. So, wow, I don't know. With brachas, I once had a shiny the other day. I asked my grandson, go online, see what brachas make. Got me an answer in a second. But wow, what a credit to that book. Pope Francis decrees new rules for reporting abuse, but there are no penalties. What if you report? What will happen? This is about the Poway community, about the beautiful Shabbos, the people that came out to give the community strength. I have more material also about Poway. This is anyone here who knows English Jewry. Peter Kalms died. It's a beautiful description of his life. I taught his children Michlala. This is someone who Chabad picked up and became an unbelievable contributor and supporter of Chabad in London. A great Jew. When he wanted to come in Aliyah, as we spoke about an hour and a half ago, the Rebbe told him, not for you. And here, two additions, also very interesting. They're rebuilding a yeshiva in the original town where the yeshiva began in White Russia. It's unbelievable. In the town of Lubavitch, they're building a yeshiva, and it's unbelievable. You got to look at the pictures. All right, it'll be a tourist attraction. It's not going to harm their economy there. That's for sure. This is by my colleague Rabbi Shalom Ber Gordon, Zichrono Livracha, Al Rebbe called him in. Was called into the Freyadiker Rebbe's room and was given a one-way bus ticket to Newark, New Jersey. And he then spent the rest of his life in Newark and then in Maplewood. Your father and uncle, believe me. Did you know? You knew him too? Okay. Baruch Hashem. And here, Chabad began a mitzvah campaign for Lori Kay, getting everyone to light Shabbos candles. The goal of 60,000 candles to be given out, to be lit on Shabbos, 1,000 for each of Lori's life. Price we pay. Okay, I want to thank you all for coming. Next week is a normal week. We pick up where we left off. Very interesting material, both on Sunday and Monday. Have a very happy Lag BaOmer.
Yom Yerushalayim.
And Yom Yerushalayim is the week after. We won't have a class on Sunday, but we'll have Monday. And that's Shuas, and that's it for now. I have a lot more to do, but that will be in America, the greater New York area.
When are you leaving?
Early July. And we have to thank Yomo. He sets up the mic. He sets up the room. I found out why they're so busy and the place looks like a pig pen. There's registration today of ladies, of girls. So if you go downstairs and put a wig on, there's coffee, cake, whatever you want, endless, but it's for the women. The men, I don't know when that'll be, but we'll find out. Charlie, have you heard from Morty?
No, he's coming back this week.
Oh, he's coming back. So, all right, no news is good news. We'll put it that way.
After Shavuot, no more classes?
Shavuot is pretty late this year, my friend.
Yeah.
The building here transfers to their summer programs, mm-hmm. and I got to get ready. I have to finish up the book and get ready for New York. Rav Hashem, we'll pick up. I'll work out at the end how I'll let everyone know when I'm starting up again.
So what topics are you going to cover from the class?
Nothing different than just continuation.
In the book, what will be?
The first section is Hafkat Kedushin. It's 120 pages. It's major. It's against Rabbi Rachman. It gives you, but it doesn't mention his name. It's very mechubit.
But is the Berkowitz also believed in
God? So I showed that you can have mekach ta'ut, but you can't have wholesale hafkat kedushin. It's a big difference. The second section is two chapters that were left out of Washington. They were combined, telescoped into one, because they didn't want the book to be over 600 pages. So I always felt bad that these chapters were never published, because their names in there of people who risked their lives to create Yiddishkeit and communist Russia. Today they're in the dustbin of history. Not everyone became like Sharansky or like Yuli Edelstein. So it's two chapters, very powerful material in toto, and a whole series of pictures that a Talmud paid to be published in color and be published properly of Russia in the 80s of these people. Very powerful pictures. The third part is what I've published over the years, and I feel it has some value for the future. So I have there, for instance, the Rav and the Rebbe, the Rav and Professor Lieberman, Meir Kahana, Making of a Gadol Natan Kamenetsky, articles along that line, Rav Reuven Katz, Degel Reuven, etc., etc. The fourth, to me, is the most important. It's pictures and documents that I've been privileged to work with. Not much, but what I have, I'm going to speak on this publicly, the history of why you revisit it. So, for instance, Art Scroll, Masora, when they describe Torah in America, it begins with Mr. Shraga Feigl Mendelovich. I have absolutely nothing against Mr. Mendelovich, but please give Rabbi Dov Revel credit. He was the first one to turn the spades. So I've written that to Art Scroll 100 times over. They told me to go fly a kite and drop off a bridge in China. I never even got an answer, which is a slap in your face. Answer me at least. Rabbi Chalapte, you answer questions. Fame, a kevet, who gives a hoot? So I uncovered the Modat Evo that Teira Vadas published the day that Rabbi Revel died. When you will see that, no comment is necessary. But I did more than that. I uncovered a student who was in Torah Vadas in December 1940 who stood before a lawyer and gave testimony, and the lawyer, an actuary, you know, stemples it that notary. It's accurate.
A notary.
What I call an actuary, a notary. And you read the testimony. Okay, that's one thing. Second thing is, I returned my Rebbe to life. One of my Rebbe in Yeshiva was Shmuel Eliezer Volk. Charlie, you heard the name when you were in Yeshiva? Rabbi Volk. Your time already, you heard the name?
Yes.
Good. When you look at the history of Yeshiva, Rabbi Volk's name is not mentioned. When you look at the picture, go upstairs of the faculty, 1944, it says, unknown. The story, I'll go very briefly. I have to go into it in detail, leave it for the future. Very briefly, Rabbi Volk was very frustrated. He was very angry. The yeshiva forced him to leave, retire. And he wrote some nasty things about rabbis Belkin, Soloveitchik, and Lem. So they decided to denude him, to get rid of him. Rakefet feels not everyone in life has mazel. The right person in the right place at the right time. I had mazel. I had very difficult years financially. I don't deny it. It's left scars on my family. They all get PhDs and MDs. Not one of them wants to be a Rebbe. One of them is Baruch Hashem teaching up a storm, but not a Rebbe. He's making Baruch Hashem. They're all good kids. I can't complain. Shomrei Torah, mitzvot. And I failed with them. They all voted. You don't know how many votes in my family were wasted on Shaked and Bennett. So on one hand, I failed. Idiots. On the other hand, the proudest guy in the world. My kids are more right-wing than I am. Okay. So, but I was in the right place. And I was the right person. And Baruch Hashem, the rest is history. We changed the world, BMT. So Rav Volk didn't have mazel. Please, he taught thousands of students.
How old was Rabbi Belkin at that point?
Rabbi Belkin already was dying when all this happened.
The Rav?
The Rav was, it's the 1970s.
What you're doing and being very polite is telling us that Rabbi Norman Lamb was a little bit vicious.
Please, don't say, Rabbi Norman Lamb is a wonderful person. I don't want to say it that way, but I do want to say that I want to identify Rabbi Volk, and there's the picture of Rabbi Volk. Then is what I'm most proud of, I worked on for years, the quintessential picture of the Rav teaching, September 1960. I was able to identify all the students in the picture. 29 out of 29. And my wife deserves credit for the end. Chaim Soloveitchik couldn't believe it. You know, it's his father covered. I told him whose face that was. I'll tell the whole story publicly how I got it. Anyway, that picture is very important. Because Charlie, maybe, it's not you, it's not Yitzchak, it's not Jack, I mean, maybe find a young man, 29 years of age, with a little brains, who wants to be wealthy. Tell him, go to work on that picture. 3 years from now, a book. The class of 1960. Revisit it. and you're going to find that sitting in that room with the Rav are the future leaders. Right-wing YU Orthodoxy, centrist YU Orthodoxy, left-wing YU Orthodoxy. And that leads me to the whole revelation of the Yitz Greenberg letter that the Rav wrote. He doesn't force his will upon students. Rav is very different. The Oscrot world could never understand him. That picture says it all. And then the next document, and that document, Ani Modela HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Dov, you're a rabbi. Who do you have shmicha from? Why you? Who signed? No, who signed in your time? Rabbi Lam and the Rav. And the Rav. Okay. Gentlemen, I present my smicha to the world. Aaron Rakefet, ordained by a lady. And that letter, what it means to me, it's unbelievable. Charlie, what's the story? Very simple. There was a Rav that, you know the name, Rav Aaron Ben Zion Shurin. Name, you know, he taught at Stern College, he wrote for the Tag, he wrote for the Mugginger. Now, he was a Europeisher, but Americanized, wrote Sfarim. His sister was married to Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Elka was a Shurin. Dov Shurin is a few, the Dov in Ephrata, he is character par excellence. Very hush of a family. When he died, his son, who happens to be my sub-student, David, his neighbor's son wanted to see the archives. So he played with the archives, and he opens up a file that says Rabbi Revel. And in the file is an envelope with a letter that was opened once, 1963, I believe it was, and never opened again, put back in and left there. And that letter is about a young kid named Aaron Rothkopf, written by Mrs. Revel to Rabbi Shurin. And as they say, the rest is history. And I have no right to reproduce that letter because it's very ragged on my part. I smack myself. On the other hand, Shmini Shemayim, a student, discovers the letter, and the letter is the greatest letter ever written about Aaron Rothkopf.
So you put it in the book?
I sure did. It's my smicha. It's right there. And if you want to see the letter, it's right in my office. It's there. It's my smicha. Wow. There's more to it, too, because Mrs. Revel writes, I knew her very well, obviously. She was a great lady. And she writes, to Rabbi Shurin, he so reminds me of my husband. And if I could only tell her, Mrs. Revel, I am your husband's blood cousin. I found it out too late to boast about it, too late to have any benefit from it, but at least they haven't retracted my doctorate. You follow? If they find out in Washington Heights and take it seriously, you got to remember Washington Heights, everything, there's so much going on, guys, see what's going on. The rebellion also, they're running there. No one, the kids come here for a year, between high school, for the first time they meet rebbeim that are grounded, that their whole life is just Torah and Yiret Shemayim, and they're grounded. You understand? You don't see this in America. In life, there is. Jackie Mason would have a field day describing being a Rebbe in America and a Rebbe in Israel. Ashreinu Shezachinu. And this July, we celebrate 50 years Al Admat HaKodesh. June 26th, we celebrate 50 years since we boarded the ship to leave America. And unlike our great grandparents, who some of them threw their kippot overboard, their talisim overboard, they say the tefillin overboard, the shekels overboard, the fish had a lot of hair to eat. Baruch Hashem, we threw our Americanisms overboard. And that is an achievement. And Charlie, today we look at our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. They know I'm going to appreciate them. They're so Israeli. It's part and parcel. Torah, Israel, Eretz Israel. The way we began 2 hours ago already, it's the basis of all our existence. Mitzvah, Yishuv, Eretz Israel. And I thank the people who complimented me, but I hate to tell you the compliments, that you had the guts to take on the Rosh Yeshiva in America, that you had the courage, that the Ribbono Shel Olam, this is Torah, the basis of our existence. And thank you all for your participation until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya.